Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files podcast, the podcast that is completely unprepared for pressing record, but fuck it, we did it anyway. My name's John Bruford. I'm one of your hosts, but in a surprise move, what we've got for you this episode is a guest interim intro stand-in temporary co-host in the shape of Mr. Scott Longley. Scott, welcome.
Thank you, John.
Okay, and it's a hell of a title I've made for you there.
I've had better titles, but I've certainly had worse titles, so I'll run with that.
I don't think you've had better titles than guest interim intro stand-in temporary co-host. I'm not sure a better title exists.
That's true. I'll put it on my LinkedIn and compare it with my other titles.
Although, are you familiar with the film The Naked Gun?
Of course.
The original film. I love the credits for The Naked Gun, because in the instances where somebody has had one sentence, they're credited as that sentence. So there's somebody on The Naked Gun who's credited as, "Hey, it's Enrico Palazzo." Now, that would be a great title. Like, if I'd done that,
that's a great title. Yes.
That'd be all it would say. I mean, at the moment, I think it says, I write and edit stuff. It would just say, "Hey, it's Enrico Palazzo." Mm.
Change it now.
Although, when they made Heathers, there's one character, I think she only gets one line in it. And it's after the two football players have in theory, had a suicide pact. It's a very dark comedy, Heathers. Very dark. But JD and Veronica are walking into school, and this girl stops in front of them really excitedly, and she just says, "Hey, did you hear? School's out today because Kurt and Ram killed themselves in a repressed homosexual suicide pact," and then runs off. And she's not credited as that, which I think they've missed the trick. Oh,
missed opportunity.
Really is. Really is. So, Scott Longley, welcome. It's been a while. I could call you a returning guest, but you're a co-host today, so I don't know how that works. No.
Okay.
How's it going?
It means that I get to do what Vinton does all the time with you, which is just to look at you bemusedly.
I was going to say nothing. He does nothing. I did the heavy lifting here. Which is clearly not true.
We all know that, John. We all
ever listened to this podcast will know that Vinton's the one that comes with the actual questions. So listeners may or may not know that you are the founder of the Concise Media Empire, including the Substack newsletters, Compliance and More, Earnings and More. Is there another one?
Yes, and that's it currently. Yeah.
Okay. Which are super. And actually, I emailed you yesterday at the time of recording this because the newsletter was so good. I emailed you to say that newsletter was so good. It's like that bit in Blackadder 2 when Francis Drake's talking to Queen Elizabeth and he's like she's losing interest in him. And he's like, "Madam, did I ever tell you of the time I fell overboard and was nearly eaten by a polar bear?" "No." "I fell overboard and was nearly eaten by a polar bear." Anyway.
Yes.
The newsletter in question, it was about Gordon Brown and stuff that's been said about the UK industry and about tax rises and all kinds of shit going on there. But the part of it that I thought was really fascinating. So you've done a Freedom of Information request, haven't you?
Yes, via Dan Moore at Regulus, who's the main FOI guy on this.
But that was really fascinating, and it's bizarre when you see an FOI response, when you get the information, it's like it's just stuffed in a box and pushed over to you. And so you've got to through loads of completely irrelevant stuff or just chains of communication. But what was the FOI request for?
Lots of it redacted.
Oh, yeah. But what was the request for and what did it produce?
Well, so it's around the... let me make sure I get my facts straight, John, which is... I'm checking
we
on the...
We do like to be accurate on this podcast.
Product. Indeed. So... It's this long running sore that the industry or parts of the industry have been attempting to rectify, I guess would be the problem, is the issue of the use of statistics by OHID, effectively, is what it comes down to. And the Department of Health and Social Care. So OHID is the Office of Health and Improvement Disparities.
Catchy.
And, well, indeed. And they put a report out, and as I say in the piece, they put a report out in January 2023, the economic and social cost of harms associated with gambling in England. And that data is somewhat contentious. Let's put it that way. I think it's the official statistics regulator has called into question those statistics from OHID. And every time they keep reappearing, because politicians obviously latch onto these kind of statistics, latch onto what they say, because it backs up certainly in terms of the anti-gambling lobby, it backs up their thoughts around the costs of gambling harms, and every time that that data gets used, the Office for Statistics Regulation wakes up and goes, "Oh, you can't use that data. We've warned you about this before. You can't use that data." And hence, the latest time that the latest instance of this data surfacing again came in Gordon Brown's article in The Guardian a few months back now, or a few weeks back, where he used the statistics to suggest that the gambling industry was bad for the country and therefore should be taxed almost to the edge of existence, I think would be the best way to put his attempt to tax it and tax them. Then apparently, by taxing the gambling industry, according to the Gordon Brown idea, you can then solve child poverty in Britain.
Which is an interesting idea, right? Because if you go back to
when
Brown was Chancellor, so we had, God, a couple of decades probably 3 decades of conservative rule in the UK. So the early-ish, early to mid-70s up to the early... 20 odd years, to the early to mid 90s. And a new Labour came in with this sort of centrist approach, lots of spin, lots of glitz, lots of people with terrifying smiles. And Brown came in as Chancellor to Tony Blair's Prime Minister, right? But what he seems to be forgetting is the role that they've played in this. And I haven't forgotten it just because it was 30 years ago. Because one of the things that government did so successfully and that he was an integral part of was they kicked problems down the road. So let's not forget, right? the UK pound used to be, like most currencies, tied to the gold standard, right? We had a fucking shitload of gold and it's our currency's worth what our reserves. Yeah, it's a major factor in the value of currency. That Labour government sold off stacks of, I don't think it sold off all of it, but they sold off stacks of our gold reserve, right? Pound no longer tethered to anything. It's just a fucking currency that people play with. Like most other currencies now, it's an idea. It's worth what somebody pays for it, and it can be destabilized, as we saw in the case of Brexit. Anyway, the other thing they did, which has definitely led us to where we are today in the UK, was they sowed the seeds to destabilize the National Health Service. And the way that they did that, and I'm sure you're aware of this, was in order to create money where there was none, to build new hospitals, etc., and be the heroes of that, and have all of the positive shit that comes with that, New Labour did this thing where they would work with private developers to build new hospitals. Okay, sort of makes sense. The government is not a construction company. Except the way the deals worked was they would sell the existing hospitals, sell the land to these property developers who would just happen to own the land where the new hospital was built. And so the NHS became a tenant, and into those contracts were built escalating rents. So for the last 30 years, every NHS trust in the UK that has built a new hospital has seen its rents go up year after year after year, contractually go up. So it's not anything to do with that standard for private tenants where your rent can't go up by more than, I think it's 10% in a year. Fuck that. This is going up by X amount and there's jack shit you can do about it. And all those NHS trusts have had to just suck that up. And people are like, well, but the NHS is underfunded. But you know what? If the NHS hadn't had that foist on it, it would be able to do an awful lot more. The NHS used to be a significant landowner in the UK. Not so much these days. But anyway, that's just something that fucking annoyed me. And it's so typical of Gordon Brown to come out with this fucking nonsense and to not say, hey, we're part of the problem. Because, yeah, okay, the Tories were fucking shite and it was more than time when New Labour came in. But New Labour has done fuck all for child poverty. Absolutely nothing. And don't get me wrong, the last 14 years or whatever we've just had of Conservative rule has crushed families. It's put so many people below the poverty line. And they've generally made cuts to the most vulnerable parts of society. When this, not this specific Tory government, but when I think it's Theresa May was Prime Minister, as soon as they got back in, the first thing that the government did was cut disability, disability support. Like, how much money is that going to save? But you put the figure out there, oh, it's going to save 500 million a year. In terms of running a country, 500 million isn't even a morning. It saved fuck all. And
well, this is where the maths doesn't add up, as we know, John. When it comes to what this government needs from in terms of tax and what it hopes to gain from the gambling industry in terms of tax, we know that it's desperate for money. And the assumption is that they're going to tax, because of what Chancellor Reeves has said publicly, that it thinks that the industry should be paying more. She didn't quite specify which parts of the industry, but we all know, I think, that remote gaming duty, i.e. the tax on iCasino or online gaming, whichever way you want to put it, that looks like it's going to go up. And it looks like it's going to go up to the extent where, according to what the government says, or at least according to what the government is hinting, that it would raise something like 2 billion extra in tax.
Which it's obviously not going to. The figures that are coming out of Holland are exactly where they should be looking. The figures that are coming out of the Netherlands are saying, yeah, the tax rate went up. Yeah, it's been brilliant. We're getting less tax now.
So, yes. So, from what I can gather, and this is talking to people who don't nobody knows at what level. Nobody knows what the government's going to do in the budget. I don't think even Chancellor Reeves knows what she's going to do in the budget. So we are somewhat guessing at what the thinking is, but it would appear to be the case that people now, that the industry has woken up to the idea that it's going to be taxed more heavily in the budget, and everybody seems to have agreed at this point, partly because of what horse racing has been doing publicly, partly because of what we know to be the complications of the debate around tax harmonisation. What everybody now assumes is that the tax that is most clearly at risk of being raised without having the consequence of seeing high street betting shops close, and there's a reason why they don't want that, because they don't want the job losses, and they don't want the empty shops and the facades. But the tax that would be the most easiest to hit is remote gaming duty, which is one of the tax which is part of the consultation on harmonisation. And I think currently that is at 21%. And the assumption from a lot of people is that they're going to raise it to either between 30 to 35 or even up to 40% from 21%. So a near enough doubling at worst and just slightly less than a doubling at best. And the assumptions behind that is that, and this has been, is, you know, part of the somewhat contentious figures put across by the IPPR and the SMF. The assumption is that would raise a ballpark £2 billion extra for the Treasury. It probably wouldn't, because as you say, we have a live, in-running, in-play example going on in the Netherlands where they raise taxes. This is across the board, so it's not specifically about online, but it's a specific online tax, but it's not just iCasino, it's sports betting as well. They've raised that tax to mid-30s, and it's going to go up again in January to to high 30% plus. And as that is going on, as they're raising taxes, as we've seen from the latest data, the black market has risen to the extent that it's now bigger than the regulated market, because for a very obvious reason, in the unrelated regulated space, you can still offer bonusing because you can afford to. And in the regulated space, you simply can't afford to offer bonusing because your margins are too slim. And therefore, the customer sees a better offer online in an unregulated space and simply switches. And it's where the arguments come in about the Laffer curve, which every sub-editor loves, because you can then do game for a Laffer as a subhead. But the Laffer curve would seem to suggest that at a certain level, taxation rates rise so high that taxation take starts to fall. And it appears to have been found, they have, as one of the commentators, I think Regulus Partis, have said, the Dutch have appeared to have found the point at which the Laffer curve occurs with gambling, and that is in around the mid to high 30%, at which point your tax take falls because customers are either not playing, well, they're not playing on the regulated space, they're either not playing at all, or more likely they're going to the black market. So bring it into a UK context where they specifically raise only the iCasino tax, with the hope of raising £2 billion extra for the Treasury. The suggestion is from the commentators, and I think this is probably correct, if you raise that tax specifically to 40%, there are bad actors in the black market who will look at that and say, well, okay, we can now offer bonusing to a huge swathe of UK consumers who previously weren't aware of what good offers we can offer compared to the minimal, say, no offers from the regulated operators. And given the rise of the black market recently, given the rise of crypto gambling, given the extent to which even government actions with regard to pornography have pushed people towards VPNs, the potential for the UK iCasino consumer to move offshore is, I suggest, very high. And if they do put the tax up to 30-40%, they will simply not get the money that they hoped for. And meanwhile, large swathes of the UK facing industry will suffer accordingly.
Yes, I agree. The thing is, so there's a couple of things in there I just want to add on a little bit. Like, I feel for the Gambling Commission in this, and that's not just because, you know, because they seem nice. I feel for the Gambling Commission in this because they're not setting these fucking taxes, but they're going to have to enforce all of this nonsense. And they're going to be blamed for it. But there's no way on earth that the Gambling Commission is saying to the government, yeah, that's a great idea. Let's do that. Not a fucking chance, in my humble opinion.
No, presumably not.
They're going to be looking at Netherlands. And those figures coming out of the Netherlands, all that information coming out of the Netherlands is coming from the regulator. And that's what makes it so extraordinary. It's the regulator's being utterly transparent, saying, holy shit, this isn't working.
It's an important point. So currently, we know that there has been a rise in black market gambling in the UK by inference rather than absolute evidence. So the commission even has kind of said in its own communications around the black market, most notably its recent report, which put out the case for who might be going offshore and why they might be going offshore, which was interesting. I think first time somebody had tried to put some kind of actual thinking behind that, or put it into a report, at least an official report. And the commission and the industry is saying that the black market is on the rise. The industry, understandably, is kind of saying it's trying to say it's bigger than people think. The commission has somewhat underplayed it to date, but is now somewhat catching up. And it can undoubtedly be said that the Dutch evidence shows very specifically how a black market benefits from bad regulation when it comes to gambling. And the UK example is not quite so clear cut, but certainly in the circumstance where a lot of play goes offshore because of a tax situation that might occur in a month's time, I'm pretty sure that the commission will be showing that data. It will show through albeit the commission data is somewhat slower to come to light than maybe the Dutch example. But eventually the data would show that there would be a fall in regulated iCasino activity. And then the inference would be that there'd be a rise in the black market. Now, politically, and this is the problem I think the industry has about the black market and the problem that the commission has, I think there are elements in the anti-gambling lobby that would see that migration to the black market as a win, because they would say, well, this is brilliant. We've taxed the industry and there is less play in the regulated market. Therefore, there is less harm being made to British people by gambling companies, at the behest of gambling companies. And because the black market is an unseen problem, and because the issues caused by black market operators wouldn't come to light due to UK Gambling Commission actions, the anti-gambling lobby would simply brush their hands and say, well, that's fine. There's no more gambling problems being caused.
Yay.
That we have no more harm being caused by iCasino operators. And therefore, they shut their hands down and say, job done.
Yeah, there is a risk of naivety winning the day. Do you think in the case of the Netherlands...
Now, obviously...
Sorry,
you carry on.
Oh, I was just thinking about the Netherlands and I was thinking, do you think that the absolute transparency that the regulator has talked about their figures, do you think that is I don't see how it can be anything else. Do you think that is an attempt by the regulator to almost appeal to the government to say, sort this out? Or do you think they're just going, yeah, there's the figures. We're still doing our job. Because the gambling commission could put pressure on.
Yeah. They're Dutch, and I don't know whether they work by the same rules as we do.
They do like efficiency, though.
I think... Well, yeah, I do. That's the Germans, isn't it? I do wonder whether or not. I mean, the Dutch government situation is obviously somewhat tenuous at the moment and politically unstable, therefore, I don't know whether the Dutch regulator saying anything about gambling has any impact at all on the current Dutch situation. Who knows? But it is honest of them to say what they're saying. I suppose from a regulator's point of view, and this would be instructive for the commission. The commission, for all its faults, I possibly am a critic unfairly of the commission sometimes, but it does try to understand the whole market, and it does try to understand the whole point about its somewhat contentious gambling study of Great Britain is it's trying to understand in more detail what's going on within the UK gambling space. And it would see, I think it would see, and I think it would do the two and two and come up with four on this, that it would see a fall in regulated iCasino activity, but a constant figure of regulated harm, of harm being reported by the GSGB, and would say, okay, well, that shows that activity hasn't reduced, activity has simply migrated offshore. Mm. And would put that, I'm sure it would put that in a report and say, I don't think it wouldn't be able to say that reduction in activity is somehow a win for gambling harm, because the gambling harm has just been shoved out of harm's way, so to speak. I think the commission would be honest about that, and it would say that. Whether anybody in government is listening, whether this government is listening to anything anywhere, is very hard to say. Whether this government can do anything other than just simply, like Sideshow Bob, constantly step on rakes that hit it on its head. I don't think it can do anything. I don't think this government will even understand what it does when it raises online gambling tax or RGD. If the government goes down the road of actually raising other taxes, i.e. machine gaming duty and potentially betting duty, it will soon see the impact, which will be closures of betting shops on the high street and also a further migration of betting activity offshore. You would hope at that point, but although that point, of course, that's probably too late for the people who've lost their jobs. It's too late for the companies that have closed their shops. It might be too late for the betting sector as a retail activity, full stop. At that point, the government might realise the error of its ways, but maybe not.
I think a couple of years ago, I did like an RG thing, and I had a shadow minister on, Alexandra. I can't remember her surname. This is really bad. But she has a South Wales constituency, and she's one of those rare politicians that's actually from a working class background. And there aren't enough of those. And I was talking to her about the role of betting shops in the community, right? And this is what the Guardian's never going to understand. This is what the government is never going to understand. A betting shop, while it is a place for people to bet, it's also a place where a small little hidden and forgotten about subset of society get their only fucking human contact. It's an important place socially in communities, in working class or deprived communities. And the other thing is, you mentioned jobs. we are talking about a reasonable amount of jobs, not that many full-time jobs, unfortunately, because they switched to a similar model to what supermarkets did, because then they don't have to do holiday pay and sick pay and that shit. But it's still a significant number of jobs, specifically in the communities that can't afford to lose them.
Yeah.
Because that is going to affect...
The problem that the industry has in explaining the impact to any given MP is that the jobs are like a handful of jobs in a shop closure, you know, so maybe 10, 20 people affected directly, presumably maybe less. I think Fred Dunn was somewhat kind of laughed at for saying like, oh, if you do this, we'll close all our shops. If they raise machine gaming duty or betting duty, they'd close all their shops. And not laughed at, but I think there's that kind of thing of like, oh, you're just saying that you're not going to close all your betting shops. But even if Betfred did close, I think it's 1,300 shops, that would be 5,000-10,000 people would be directly losing their jobs, but it wouldn't be happening in one constituency or two or three constituencies. It'd be happening across every constituency across Britain, and therefore isn't seen to be as harmful as a factory closing in a certain district. But
that's one operator, and it's going to be more than one operator doing it. But also, I think it is where the racing strike thing, you know, and the all of that contentious shit going on within the BGC. And I said years ago, the BGC can't possibly work because there are too many conflicting interests. It doesn't make sense. Anyway, what do I know? But out of interest, John,
what's your thought about the racing strike and racing's apparent switch of loyalties in recent months?
I'd like to say it's recognition that the BGC can't work as a concept, but I don't think it goes that deep.
No.
It's... These are things that probably should have happened behind closed doors, and I don't know what efforts were made to have these conversations behind closed doors. That this ever made it public, I find a bit bizarre, because usually that's an act of desperation. But tied to what we're talking about the closure of betting shops and all of that, that would kill the racing industry.
This is where it's tricky, I think, because I can understand, as you say, so this shouldn't have taken place publicly. There shouldn't have been a strike in the way that it was, I don't think. Shouldn't be the split between racing and the betting industry is harmful to both industries and only benefits the anti-gambling lobby. And I think that's why the anti-gambling lobby has been so concentrated on attempting to affect this split.
Yeah, they've not been deaf about that, have they?
For the racing industry to believe, if there's anybody in the racing industry who believes that the betting industry being hit by taxes in any part of the business doesn't affect their world, then they don't understand the economics of industry and how businesses work. So from my understanding, if any tax rise affects the industry, the mitigation or affects any one company, the mitigation of that tax rise, the attempt to make it less harmful to the bottom line of any given business means you cut costs. And you don't just cut costs in the bit of business that was affected by the tax rise. So if any given operator loses a part of its revenues from iCasino because the tax has gone up, and the players are simply not there anymore, that will affect the whole business. And the cost cutting that will be affected at that point will affect the whole business, and that will include racing, or sorry, the betting industry, looking at the shops and looking at the costs that are accompanied by having to do, to have all the pictures, to have all the data in the shops. And they will look at that and they will say, if we cut out all of that cost of having to pay racing for its data and for its pictures, we can save ourselves X. And that will partly mitigate the Y that we've lost from the tax rise. And so that seems to me to be logical. And I don't understand why people in racing don't see that. I understand that people in racing probably look at me and go, well, you're just a plant for the gambling industry. And to an extent, I am. That's effectively the milieu in which I exist. But I can see the logic that the costs of an extra of a tax rise will affect the whole of a business, and that the cost cutting will include them looking at the amount of money they pay to racing currently, and they'll look at that as a cost which may no longer be worth bearing. And at that case, racing is, to pardon my French, fucked.
If you're a Flutter or somebody like that, say you've got a bit of retail estate in there, for the amount it contributes to your overall pot, that is going to be the first to go, because proportionally it doesn't make nearly enough money. And you're dead right.
Yeah.
That's going to be the first place they look at cost cutting, because staff costs, national insurance, rents. I mean, fucking hell. Rents have just gone crazy the last bunch of years. And you're going to have more high streets with less money in. You're going to have fewer employees paying income tax, etc. And the knock-on is actually significant. And as you say, the racing industry is the one that is going to really, really get this in the neck, because I don't know whether this is being a little too brutal, but you've got to wonder if the operators need those headaches, need those retail headaches. Are they going to suffer if the racing industry as we know it goes? Well, iCasino is the most profitable part. That doesn't need horse racing.
No.
And,
I think there's a wider question. Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a wider question that I've asked a few people about, and it is interesting to the extent to which horse racing is actually a lost leader for some operators, that it's not the profit and the revenue driver, certainly not the profit driver, and arguably not the revenue driver that it was. With some operators, the costs, we know the costs of the pictures and the data and everything that the various racing organizations arc and everything takes out of the pot, the levy, all of this, that cost is rising and is becoming ever more onerous as far as the bookies are concerned. Regardless of what happens with other taxes, that's already the case. We know that horse racing is not the main product for any of these major operators now. And in that circumstance, if it becomes the product that is the most expensive, but isn't even the most important to them in terms of their revenue and their profit, then what do you think is going to happen there? And the fact that racing sees itself in this privileged position, because it's been encouraged by generations of bookies who will turn up at Cheltenham and say, of course racing's really important to us. And they'll sit in their boxes and look down on the rest of the world and say, yeah, of course, events such as Cheltenham are very important to us. But that, the equivalent of the Wet Wednesday in Stoke, that race meeting in Ludlow or that race meeting in Plumpton on a Wednesday afternoon where they're paying through the nose for substandard product, which nobody's interested in betting on and which simply feeds into a shop estate where nobody's watching. That's unsustainable.
Well, and speaking about property developers, just imagine how many houses you could build on a racecourse.
Well, a lot, although some of them are in flood areas. So
yes.
You have to bear that in mind.
that doesn't stop them. I do need to chip in here and just mention that that Optimove
you're sponsored are the by creators the BHA.
Of no, I was actually going to say I'm not a shill for the gambling industry because everybody hates me equally. So no, I wanted to mention our sponsors, Optimove, who are the creators of Positionless Marketing and the number one player engagement platform. Now, I can't tell you about them being at SBC Lisbon, and Fintan's got the ad read for them, so I haven't got it. So I'm just making this shit up now. But if you mention to Optimove...
I'm sure they enjoyed SBC Lisbon.
I'm sure they did. The feedback from everybody that was there said it was very, very good. Optimove, me and Fintan had the demo. We were genuinely blown away by it. Talk to them if you need a bit of CRM, regardless of the size of the business, talk to them because you'll be stunned. And if you tell them that you came via us, then you'll get a month free. So it's a bargain. What can I say? But also, Scott, did you know that one of our other sponsors is EveryMatrix, who are delivering advanced turnkey platform technology to the global regulated iGaming and lottery industries with outstanding results? Did you know that?
I did know that, yes.
Fuck, man, I'm preaching to the choir. Did you know that they're powering the world's biggest brands?
I didn't know that.
Now you do. They're also solving your biggest challenges, maybe not yours. I don't know what your biggest challenges are.
I don't think they can help me with my biggest challenges, but we'll move on from that.
I was wondering if they could help me with mine, but I think I was going to get Optimove involved with my online dating issues, see if they could help me with retention.
I think you might want to do something about your pissing dog, I think, on that front.
No, I'm telling you, he threw up water. It wasn't piss. Also, because it was in three separate sites. Before we started recording, I was a little bit late because the dog had created wet patches on the carpet. But bizarrely, I think he threw up water rather than... Yeah, but anyway. Sorry, EveryMatrix. And they're taking your business to the next level. EveryMatrix, everything is possible. That little flourish at the end.
Is that the sound of your dog? Is that the sound of your dog throwing up water?
What are they going to think when they hear this? They're going to be like, fucking hell, we've got a dog vomit promo. What the fuck have they done? You know? But it's like whenever I go to Vegas, I always make sure I'm wearing a pink shirt because Americans don't wear pink shirts. Like, oh, that dude in the pink shirt. Yeah. So, you know, EveryMatrix, I hope, are going to be really happy with that because they'll be like, people will be like, EveryMatrix, oh, yeah, the dog threw up water. Yeah. Where do we sign?
Threw up water, yeah.
And finally, our last sponsor is Clarion Gaming, the mighty, mighty Clarion Gaming, organizers of ICE, which is just a few months away in Barcelona in January. I think it's the 19th to the 21st. I'm very excited, not least because we're hosting the Gambling Book Awards at the event.
Which, of course you are. Actually, here's a gambling book you should read. Alexander Baron, Low Life. He's dead. He's obviously not going to be up for the award. It describes greyhound racing in the 1960s. In Hackney.
Oh, that does sound good.
It is a good book, anyway.
Oh. Violence, Revenge, Payback. Sounds like a winner.
Yeah.
But it does tie in neatly with... because this is actually the intro to an episode, not the episode. But it does tie in neatly with the guest that I interviewed this guest by myself. Fintan wasn't available. But I spoke to, this is our first author interview from a book submitted for the awards. We met the magnificent, and I'm not exaggerating here, she's amazing. The author's name is Alex O'Brien. She's a very keen poker player, not pro, probably not even semi-pro, but a very passionate poker player. And she's all about showing people how the skills that poker requires can be applied to everyday life. And about how it can sort of teach you the principles of critical thinking. And backs the whole thing up with research and interviews. So the book is called The Truth Detective, A Poker Player's Guide to a Complex World by Alex O'Brien. And Alex is a fantastic guest. Like, I emailed her afterwards to say, dude, you can come on anytime. And surprisingly, she hasn't replied. So maybe it went into her spam. I don't know. But in all honesty, it's a terrific book. It's a really good read. She's a brilliant writer. Really, really good writer. She's her profession is she's a science writer, and she's brought that to the book. So it's like you state your hypothesis, then you prove it. And I love that. I love that whole approach, because it's a no bullshit book, and it actually goes into the mechanics of bullshit. Fantastic.
Wow. He wants to go into the mechanics of bullshit. I don't think you come out of it, do you?
Oh, it's good. It's led me to reassess some of my personal relationships. I don't talk to Fintan anymore.
That's about time.
I'm only saying that because I know he's not listening.
he's led you astray for long enough, John.
It really has, man. It's been 4 years. Just imagine what I could have done in those 4 years.
Oh, yeah.
I could have napped a lot more. Man. But anyway, so we're going to meet Alex O'Brien now. Thank you to Scott Longley for talking about everything that's been going on in the UK, because we're in such a strange place in the industry here. It's wild.
Absolute pleasure, John. Great to speak to you.
If you're not already subscribed, Scott, what's the URL to go and find your works?
Earningsandmore.com and compliancesandmore.com. There you go.
The newsletters are excellent. Genuinely, I rate them up there with Steve Ruddock's and Dustin Gaukas. Really, really, really good work. And I'm a big fan. For what that's worth, that might turn people away. I don't know.
An awful lot to me. An awful lot to me, John. It always means a lot.
Set the bar low, Scott. Then you can't be disappointed. As I always like to say, people are always like, how's it going, John? I go, well, I haven't shit myself yet today. And I was like, oh, I'm just setting the bar really low, whilst appreciating that there is still a chunk of day left for that to happen.
Yeah. Yes.
And it sometimes it just takes one errant sneeze and the complexion of your day has changed entirely.
As you age, as a famous, I think it's one of the Rolling Stones said this, as you age, one of the great lessons in life is never trust a fart.
It's 100% true. And when you can't trust your own wind, it's a sad day, but it does come to a swell.
Sad day. Yes. Right.
Scott Longley, thank
you. Appreciate it, John.
Meet Alex O'Brien.
Cheerio.
We're joined by this week's guest, and I'm very excited about this week's guest, not just because she's this week's guest, although that is a part of it. I'm excited about this week's guest because this week's guest is our first guest of the sort of the new ilk, the new era of the Gambling Files podcast, because she is the first, she's not the first author we've had on, we've had loads of authors on, but she's the first author that's on as a result of the Gambling Book Awards, the initiative we've launched, which will be awarded at ICE in January. Her book is called The Truth Detective, Lessons from Poker on Risk, Reward, and Imperfect Information. And it's a real pleasure to welcome Alex O'Brien. Alex, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to have this conversation with you.
Well, you know, Fintan would have loved to be here. He's actually, for once, I take the piss out of Fintan a lot just because he's got hair. But he would have loved to be here because we both love writers. And we both love sort of supporting and championing writers and sort of saying to people, hey, shit, you should read this.
Oh, thank you.
So your book, and I know I told you this before we started recording, but, you know, nobody was listening then. Your book was recommended by former podcast guest Brandy Black, who was like, I think she's a friend of yours. And she said, is this in the awards? You know, how does it work? How do I blah, blah, blah. And I said, actually, that would fit right in. But here's what's interesting. For me, anyway. So The Truth Detective is a paperback, but I've tweaked the rules so that paperback editions can be submitted if the hardback edition wasn't submitted. So as long as a book has only been submitted once in the entire life of the awards, not just that year, but only once in the entire life of the awards, then it's okay for it to be for the paperback edition to be submitted. I didn't do that especially for you.
Oh, well, I thank you. I'm excited that it's sort of part of this new initiative. And, you know, I'm a huge bookworm, and I always say I cannot walk past a bookstore because it's like my crack cocaine. I have to go in and I cannot leave without having bought something. I just genuinely love reading. So it's always such a pleasure, no matter what the categories and field it is, to see that people are generally champion writing and book writing specifically. So when my publisher got in touch saying, these guys want to talk to you about, you know, your book being entered into the awards, I'm like, what? This is very cool. So thank you. And I like being first. So good to be here.
Honestly, it's genuine. It's an absolute pleasure. I'm not going to bullshit you and say that I've read the book.
Always good not to bullshit me.
Yeah, given the nature of the book, fuck me. I've only read the first part and I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to fucking fake my way through this. To be fair, I'm not that kind of person anyway. But I've read probably a quarter of it.
Thank you.
And I'm genuinely, no bullshit at all, I'm genuine. I'm really enjoying it. I would have made it further through it, but the cat's been ill and I had the kids at the weekend.
Hey, we're all multitasking. We all have to have various.
You're saying I should have done better.
No, no, not at all. It's so hard. It's so hard to, in this day and age, when so much, and I say this in the book, later and as you read, you'll come across it, that the most valuable currency in our day-to-day, in today's lives, is our attention. This is what everybody wants from us, right? And it's fragmented so heavily, even for our children, that sort of carving out some time to read, no matter how short a time, is really important because it kind of disconnects you from all the noise that surrounds you, and it's a really important task. So even though you're only a quarter in, and I'm glad to hear that you're enjoying it, because I think the beginning pages of a book is sort of a make or break, you know? I used to force myself to read because I love books, and I feel like I owed the books to read them. But in my old age, I'm like, oh no, sod this. Life is too short. I am not going to struggle. If an author can't capture my attention, and this is what I mean, if a book is able to keep you going in this day and age, we're doing really well.
I think, a huge amount of attention, the way the book publishers work, you know, you're not getting an agent, you're certainly not getting a publisher unless you've got a stunningly good first three chapters. I remember it was the historian by Elizabeth Kostova famously went to auction. The rights for it went to auction. It went for an insane amount of money. And don't get me wrong, it's a terrific book. But the first three chapters are breathtakingly good.
Oh,
like,
bad.
Absolutely beautiful. And actually, I recently read, and I'm sure you're probably aware of this, as an avid reader, I recently read Lessons in Chemistry.
Oh, it's fantastic. I read it 5 years ago, I think. It is so good.
But one of the second or third best opening line stroke paragraph I've ever read of any book type.
It's a breathtakingly brilliant it is so
opening
good.
Paragraph. But it's the opening paragraph is a single sentence, for one thing. It's a long run-on sentence, which in itself is really hard to pull off. To pull that off as your opening paragraph, I was just like, okay, you've got my attention.
Yeah.
And then went on this incredible journey and loved it.
Yeah. The TV series, I actually, you know, Apple did a multi-part TV series of it, but it just didn't translate for me. I just
renewed my subscription to Apple. Because Slow Horses has started up again.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And I thought I can do the adaptation, because actually I like the casting. I thought Brie Larson was quite an interesting choice.
Yeah, and she's a good Elizabeth. But
in my head when I was reading it, I had Emily Blunt.
Oh, she would have been amazing.
I think she would have been perfect, pretty much.
Yeah.
The right balance, because Brie Larson's like, I don't know how to describe it. Brie Larson's quite, I don't know whether this is because I'm associating her with Captain Marvel, but she's quite tough-looking. She's quite strong.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? She's like,
I think there is a strength to that character. We are talking about a completely different book right now, but, you know, it is an amazing book. It's a best-selling book.
Absolute beauty.
But and it has a lot of science in it, actually, and because the author herself was really into, you know, was doing some science writing herself and really into rowing, you know, so hence why all that detail about the rowing. So I'm not going to give away too much about it, but it's fascinating. And I absolutely steamed through that book. Yeah, it's really good.
Do you know, I did the opposite. It took me ages to read it because I was enjoying it so much. I just dragged it out.
Oh, that's nice too.
I was like, I'm enjoying visiting so much. I'm just gonna.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother of my children is a former rower, so that was quite interesting to read about the obsessive nature of rowers, which I can totally attest to.
But most sports, including poker, right? You kind of have to be obsessive to see, and by obsessive, I think we mean dedication to consistency. And as you're consistent, you build up strength and knowledge and you know, resilience.
You used a word before we started recording, not in this context, but you used the word perfectionist. You described yourself as a perfectionist.
Yeah, I aim
and
at perfectionism, that, but I'm not.
Perfectionism in sports, though, is greatly encouraged. It's that laser focus that athletes have. But once you take people outside of sports, perfectionism in everyday life is just crippling. It's just it's one of the most damaging traits I've ever seen in a human being.
I think perfectionism has a sort of a negative connotation, but I think we aim towards perfectionism. What we're really trying to do is progress, right? We always say practice makes progress to our daughter rather than practice make perfect, because it's about progress. It's about continuing to evolve, continuing to grow. And as humans as well, just because we, you know, I say that as parents as well, just because we become parents doesn't, we're not suddenly superhumans. We're still growing, we're still learning, and we're doing that on the job. So we need to be gentler and kinder to ourselves, but it doesn't mean we're not going to aim for, you know, perfectionism.
I think that's a different kind of perfectionism. And perfectionism in athletes is because you have the top standard. You have your qualifying standards, you have world records, etc., and they are lines in the sand. And I think that that is a different kind of perfectionism to let's be better every day. Let's try and achieve. That's like they've reached a point at which they are competitive at world level or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, it's those tiny, tiny margins, those little gains, those fractions of a percent. And once they're out of that, I mean, so many athletes fall into addiction, fall into mental health problems and all of that because they don't have the structure of training anymore. There's no longer these. Did you see the movie The Hurt Locker?
Years ago. This is an old movie.
Yeah, yeah. There's an incredible scene in The Hurt Locker where I think it's Jeremy Renner. He's back from doing all the bomb disposal stuff and he's in the supermarket. And his wife just says to him, get some cereal. And the camera just shows him tiny in front of this massive wall of different cereals. And it's just overwhelming.
It is, even for a normal person. You know, you go to New Jersey and there's like an entire aisle of different types of pasta sauce. You know, I mean, you know.
Just buy tomatoes, for fuck's sake.
Or something. Yeah, it can be overwhelming. In terms of performance, though, for athletes, that is absolutely, that's what they signed up for, right? Because they...
That's what makes them great athletes.
It's a competition. But we're all competitors to a degree. I mean, this is what I love about poker because it taps into my competitive streak. And, you know, we were talking before we started recording, like I love the fact that I can be both a science writer and a poker player. And poker really taps into sort of my competitive side. I used to do triathlons before we had our child. You know, you can't reasonably dedicate yourself to triathlons. The training alone sucks out all the time in your day. And now I've found poker, and it is in the same way. You know, it's about outsmarting. Competing, outlasting, and it's fun. It's not so much about the money aspect. You know, it is ridiculous that, you know, my very passionate side, which is science writing, is very, very hard to make. I mean, you have to be at the top of your game to make a living. Now, you have to be either on staff or have several good editors that you work with for commissions, or you write books and then you give talks. You know, it's a combination of stuff. We glamorize both jobs in many ways, but both jobs require an incredible amount of time and effort and focus. And I say this very openly that, you know, for me to become one of the top players, I know I will never become one of the top players in the world because it just requires an enormous amount of time and dedication to study and to compete. I play a handful of big tournaments a year. I never miss Vegas. I never miss the Irish Open. And then, you know, it's whenever I can. And then, you know, it's good. It's still in my life, but it's not the dominant form of engagement for me. Yeah.
Well, the book, because eventually we're going to have to talk about it.
Yeah.
The book in fact, I think you might even describe it as such in the book. It's a Venn diagram of science writing and poker. And the book is the overlap.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of overlap.
There's a ton of overlap. Absolutely.
Just on the subject of Venn diagrams, I think I have probably said it on this podcast before, but the two best Venn diagrams I've ever seen are one of them was for the term, what the fuck? What the fuck?
Uh-huh.
What fuck? The fuck? What the fuck?
Okay, I'm trying to visualize it now. I get it. Okay,
but possibly the best one was people from Hull and people who invented the Venn diagram.
people from Hull and people again.
Peter Venn was from Hull and he invented the Venn diagram.
Oh, was he? I did not notice. He taught me something. I'm so grateful.
It's just a fantastically crap piece of information that I found represented as a Venn diagram.
And not if it comes up at University Challenge or Jeopardy, you know.
Never gonna happen.
You never know. It's good information.
So the book's about this overlap. Now, this first chunk that I've read, you go into critical thinking and the importance mm-hmm. of critical thinking. But what I loved in it, arguably my favorite thing in it, is that you are very careful and very quick to address your definitions, right? So you clarify misinformation and disinformation. You clarify, I can't remember what the other one was, and I loved it. I really, really liked it. But it's
bullshit. Yeah,
critical thinking and criticism.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's like saying it out loud. It's fucking obvious. But it's not to everybody.
No.
Like, it probably is to me, because I write and stuff and use words and things. In theory.
And there's a whole chunk, and when you get deep into the book, there's a whole chunk on actual words as well. So semantic analysis, you know, what the smallest words like pronouns really...
as a science writer as well. I had this conversation with my stepdaughter years and years and years ago. I used some word and she's like, what does that mean? And I explained what it means. And she said, why didn't you just say that? I said, but I did. I said that very precisely. I just used a word that you didn't know yet. Mm-hmm. And it's like, when it comes to science, but particularly law, mm-hmm. words have such very, very specific meanings. And there's one, this is something I'm really enthused about because it fucking pisses me off. But I've corrected people on this several times. It's one of the reasons I'm so popular. When people apologize, I'm sorry if I upset you. No, you're sorry that you upset me. If I upset you is putting the blame with me. That I upset you is you accepting you fucking upset me.
Yeah, that's good semantic analysis there. Yeah.
Very different sentences, yeah. Very different apologies.
Yeah, that's why paying attention to words is so important, but paying actively listening. And there's a section in the book where I'm talking about, you know, debating with others, like being open to, you know, having a discourse with people that don't share our opinions, yeah. And to then take winning off the table. So if we come in to a conversation and are so focused on, no matter what, I have my talking points, I have my arguments, I'm going to win them.
I'm right.
And of course I'm right. If you're going in with that mindset, you are actually never going to listen to the words the other person is going to say or wants to tell you. So you're not communicating, you're monologuing past each other. And then once you start paying attention, you're actually hearing what the points of grievances, the issues are more clearly. And I think we could all do better with that, to be able to really listen to others and try to understand. And this is where poker comes back in, right? We learn very quickly in poker that it's not just about the two cards or five cards or cards, any cards that you're dealt, because there are different variations of poker, but it's also about understanding what your opponents, the other players, might be holding and what their motivations might be or what their strategies might be. So if you then take the focus away from yourself and then start thinking about others, then your decision making becomes a little bit more, a bit more informed, less self-focused, and more cautious and more preventative. So you're more able to react to what's happening once you start anticipating or understanding that that might be the case. So it's easier for you to navigate and less likely to run into traps. So there's a lot of sort of overlap in both life and poker. And it's a really good tool to hone critical thinking. So critical thinking is not one thing. It's a number of things, a number of skills that you bring together to then, you know, understand the world around you, which is part of the reason why I've been teaching our daughter how to play poker, because I feel it's such a valuable skill set she can have. Because as poker players, we have to ask ourselves a range of questions. It's almost like a checklist in our head, right? So we assess how many players, what are the stack sizes, what positions are there, what happened previously. Might a person be visibly on tilt? Do I want to check raise? Are we close to the money? You know, are we about to, you know, burst a money bubble? Strategies change. And just getting into the habit of constantly interrogating information. And that's what I want for our daughter, that she doesn't take things on face value, and that she, you know, makes the effort to go and find, if it's an important subject to her or an important anything, that she does the legwork, that she goes out and finds the information she needs to feel more confident in her decision making.
She sounds much smarter than my kids. And kids, if you're listening, I don't mean it, but my kids will be playing like Roblox or something, and they'll be, one of them will go like, they're giving away free Robux at such and such a thing. And I'm like, yeah. Are they though? What do Robux cost? Why would somebody be giving them away for free? What do they want from you?
Actually, Roblox specifically, I know you're bringing this up and has nothing to do with the book, but Roblox specifically, I have banned. They're just safeguarding of the platform. Roblox, the company itself, is not taking it serious enough. We're now mid-October in 2025. Hopefully that might change. But it is too easy for adults to pretend that there are 5-year-olds or 6-year-olds and infiltrate the games that are specifically for younger children. And there's not much that, and it's just some games that are for younger children have too much violence or sexualized elements in there. So I'm sorry if your kids are playing it, but I totally banned that one. It's not,
okay. I won't tell my kids. I said you can do something.
I did not, I'm sure your children are much older than mine, so hopefully they'll be a little bit more internet safety aware.
How old is your daughter?
She's going to be 10 this week.
Yeah, same age as my middle one.
Oh, okay. But look, the reality is, actually coming back to the book about this kind of thing, is that these threats or these dangers are all around us, and they will not stop. So as parents, it is for us, again, it is our task to go on and actively be participating and finding out things. And, you know, she goes, look, mommy, it's for my age group. Yeah, we cannot leave that sort of responsibility with software companies, internet. We have to be part of it. So for example, if she's going to play a new game, I need to sit, or one of us needs to sit next to her and just check it out, right? Minecraft, I'm totally cool with, because it's actually fun and not as brutal as some of the Roblox stuff that I've seen. But yeah, it's and in the way I explained this to my daughter, who's like, but it's fine. I actually sit her down and I make her watch some of these YouTube things from, you know, the New York Times, or parents who have been interviewed that had very unfortunate things happen to their children. And, you know, she's old enough to hear it. And before, I would explain it in a sort of a more softer term, but I always explain it to her. And I think as humans, we have to bring people along when we are making statements. If you just make a blank statement and you don't verify it or back it up, you're not going to bring your audience along. And as writers, you know this, right? The book throughout is make statements and then brings a ton of verification with it and backing it up. Because what I'm trying to say is, so I am just I'm a reporter, right? He are all the facts I'm bringing you. You make up your mind. So people have read this book with different lenses in their head. Some people thought it was highly political. Some people read it as a business book. Some people read it as a self-help book. Some people thought, actually, a handful of people thought it was a poker book and then realized it was not a poker book and then loved it and then wanted to learn how to play poker. So it does different things for different people. But my job was really to show the sort of, like we said, the Venn diagram between the two different fields that are actually quite similar in their approaches. You know, like all the different poker skills that you bring into the table are actually underpinned by scientific methods. And then we take a deep dive into the scientific methods, and you will have already gotten to that where, you know, we're talking about critical thinking and the heritage and how that permeates when it's done well into success. And that's what we really want, right? How do we successfully lead a line and how do we make best decisions? And it doesn't prevent you. The reality here is, I am monologuing, I'm really sorry, but I'm so passionate about this. But the reality here is, poker is again a very good metaphor or mirror to real life. You can hold the best hand, you can make every decision the correct way, and you could still lose. This is why I love poker and prefer poker to chess in terms of teaching tool for my daughter. She's an amazing chess player as well, but in chess, she needs to just know the moves. And if she's better than, like, knows more moves than the other players, she's going to win all the time. In poker, your hand's equity and value pre the community cards that fall on the board can be at 90%, but then only up to all the cards falling on the board. And that changes the story. And you can very easily lose with aces. Well, not easily, but you can lose with aces, you know, the best hand pre-flop in poker. And that is, you make peace with that fact. And you make peace with the fact that there will be challenges in life. There will be things that don't work out. And what poker really does, the more you play, it trains you in how to deal with failure and how to deal with things not going your way. So I'm going to stop there now. It's gone on to
it. No, the thing is, what you call monologuing, when somebody's speaking passionately about something, there's nothing better. There's nothing better to listen to. Thank at you. All. Something you said in there about teaching your daughter poker, I remember years ago I was reading about how poker is used by parents in China to get their kids ready for business. And as soon as I read that, I thought, we are so fucked, because my kids are trying to dent my lampshade with a broom handle. And in China, kids are playing poker. You know, that's such a one-sided fight suddenly. But I can 100% see the value in children learning those principles.
And, you know, sort of coming to the gambling, because this is about the Gambling Book Awards, so now we're bringing it back to the gambling aspect. The reason there is so much, the reason we did a BBC documentary about why I'm teaching my daughter how to play poker, it's called The Poker Parent, was really to shed some light onto poker and bring it out of the gutters. Like, this poker as a game is misunderstood. It has a reputation issue because a lot of people think it's gambling. But what this book, The Truth Detective, actually really dismantles that argument chapter by chapter, because it shows that actually it's a highly cerebral, multidimensional puzzle game. And the more you study it, the better you get. And the element variance, which we were talking about earlier with the aces, for example, you reduce that element the more skilled you get. So, you know, what I do love about it as well is that it trains your probabilistic thinking. It trains you to think in sort of managing risk in your head, and you do it on the spot all the time. We do these sort of assessments throughout the day hundreds of times, and the more we do, the better. But if we have sort of a base training where we gamifying this kind of thinking by playing poker with our children, then we're giving them an edge over everybody else in life.
Well, it does also bring us to another mutual friend.
Go on.
Rebecca Scales, who has been on the podcast with Lupe, her Lupe friend. In,
yes, yes.
Who's they just also have awesome, a podcast. Fabulous. Oh, well, do you know how I met Rebecca?
Go on.
This is going to sound a little bit bonkers, right? I was in Vegas one spring, and I was going from, I think it was from Aristocrat, you know, the slot company. I was going from Aristocrat's facility, which is way past the airport, that sort of south of Vegas, I think, I was staying at the downtown Grand just off Fremont Street. And Rebecca back then was driving Uber as well as everything else she was doing. And Rebecca picked me up, okay, and we got stuck in traffic and we got talking. And so I'm like, well, I'm a journalist specializing in the casino industry. And she's like, oh. And of course we stayed in touch. And so I've been sort of keeping up on all the things that she's been doing with the Women's Poker. Is it the Women's Poker Tour?
Yeah, WPA, Women's Poker Association.
That's it, WPA. And all the cool things that her and Lupe have been doing, and just nice people.
Yeah. No, I'm, you know, there's a lot of really hardworking women in the industry, and Rebecca's definitely at the top there with Lupe. Grateful.
Because there were women-only tournaments, if I remember right.
Yes.
In the women's only tournaments, I mean, how comparable is the prize money? Because I know that in general in poker, it's not like men's tournaments and women's tournaments, it's like mixed tournaments. And don't get me wrong, some of the horror stories I've heard about the way women have been treated at the poker table makes my fucking piss boil. So I understand. I'm not one of those people who's going to say, "Well, when are we going to get men only tournaments?" Because that's a fucking stupid thing to say. Sorry.
Okay.
See, this is something I'm passionate about. Now,
and you know, you will get to a story in the book when we're talking about emotions, and when you know, emotion science, and we're meeting masters of micro expressions, like a professor in San Francisco who is reads the little twitches in your face and helps you with that. And there's a scene where I'm basically having to really control my emotions because I'm basically attacked on my gender. This is years ago, nobody came to my rescue. And I was so, so angry and so fuming. I had to sort of channel my inner monk and really stay calm. But it's different now. So a lot of work has been done. There's a lot of really important industry people that have been paving the way. There's Rebecca and Lupe in the US. In Europe, there's Imran Montealegre and Kerry Jane Craigie,
Kerry Jane at the Hippodrome. She's also been on the podcast.
Oh, has she? Okay, wonderful. Yeah, well, she's sort of my boss because I host her the cash stream once a month for the Hippodrome Casino. So I commentate on it. So
and Simon's call a boss. Been on a couple of times as well.
Yeah, so just lovingly call. But Kerry Jane, she last year in December hosted the very first women's only festival here in London. And it was such a huge success. She repeated it in the summer. And as part of that, on the back of that success, now the Irish Open is doing something very similar. They did a concept tournament during the Women's Festival where they had 50% men and 50% women starting at the same time. So any woman had to basically find, they didn't have to enter as a team, but they had to get to registration in pairs of twos. A man had to be with a woman had to be with a woman. Just so leveling the playing field, you know, having both genders equally represented.
It's really interesting.
It's fun.
Because behavior is totally different.
Yeah, and the men enjoyed it more. And, you know, whenever I speak about it, and a lot of people who have played it will come up to me saying, you know, when are you going to do the next one? I'm like, I'm not the one to ask. Ask Kerry. And the Irish Open has now kings and queens. They're doing something similar where they're, again, starting a tournament. And it's brilliant, right? So there's a number of things. It's slow, but it's happening and it's growing. And there's a lot of amazing female players. I mean, you can, you know, Kristen Foxen, Alex Foxen's wife, absolute steamrolled to the first place of earnings, like Juan Liu, one of the top players, Maria Ho. I mean, we have so many amazing. Victoria Lifshitz, who has also done, you know, she started playing poker during COVID, I think it was, loved the game. She's a chess player. You know, that analytical thinking really is helpful when you come into poker from chess. She started a group called Pocket Queens. That's grown to hundreds. And now she's started up a training software called Octopi Poker. I mean, women are really strong in the industry.
What was that poker
Octopi.
Octopi?
Octopi Poker, yeah.
What does that mean?
I think because there's like, she explained it on a podcast.
Oh, man, you better not be saying that's the plural of octopus because that's one of my pet hates.
Octopi Poker. I think it is Octopi Poker.
The plural of octopus is octopuses or octopodes. It's not octopi.
I don't know if it's meant to be plural, but it's Octopi Poker. But if it's from the Latin, it's supposed to be octopi, no?
If it's not Latin, though. Octopus isn't a Latin word. It's a Greek word.
Oh, well, then, and that...
That's why it's octopuses or octopodes.
Oh, right. You see? Gosh, there you go.
Super common misconception and one that my smart ass kids have carried around with them since they were old enough to talk.
Oh, good, good. We do need
these. We need pedants.
Yeah, I do get really not angry, but I have to take deep breaths when people say fishes. I'm like, fish, fish, it's fish. Fish is fish, you know.
You should see the different colors I can turn.
Yeah, so yeah, the prize pools, just to round up that conversation, the prize pools for women's tournaments are growing and they are not,
they'll grow with participation, won't they?
Absolutely,
in theory.
Absolutely, with big games. And the Winter Festival was the biggest in numbers in terms of outside of Vegas, outside of the US. So, you know, big milestones are being achieved, but not because it's a collaboration, you know, and these trailblazers are not doing it by themselves. We've got the likes of PokerStars are putting their weight behind it. And, you know, the media is highlighting more women in the industry, and that's really important. And then when things like the scenario that I'm describing in the book happen to women, they're rarer. And when they do happen, people are more likely to step up because they feel more confident that they can, you know, support women. So it's a good, we're moving in the right direction. There's a lot more work to be done. Just happy with the progress, no matter what. And yeah.
Is The Poker Parent the next book?
Well, we are in proposal stages. It's perhaps not going to be called that, but it's definitely about that. So yeah, so we're working on finalizing the book proposal. As you know, with nonfiction books, you have to you don't write the whole book. You write a sample chapter and chapter overviews and a business plan. The book proposal is like a blueprint for the actual book. And then if somebody buys it, then you go and write the rest of the book. So we are at that point where we're not just tweaking sentences, but we're nearly there for it to be sent out. So hopefully, you know, by early 2026, we'll have some good news and I can get stuck into the next project. I didn't want to write it initially because I didn't read any poker parenting books because I just felt like they were too dogmatic, the ones that I picked up. And but yeah, I just figured out a way of putting something together that empowers parents and makes them feel happy and makes them feel comforted in that we are failing and we're going to fail and it's okay. And we can't always get it right because we're learning on the job. So yeah, there's a lot of precious parents' experience. And I've said it all the time, you know, just because I've given birth doesn't make me suddenly like superhuman or all knowing. And I don't know all the planets and all the galaxies and the chemical breakdowns of certain materials. You know, our daughter will ask me, like, I don't know. It's okay to say, I don't know, you know, but then to say, let me find out for you and I will learn about it and come back to you. You know, just mirroring behaviors that they can adopt as well. So rather than spewing off made up facts, we go, hang on, let me figure it out and come back to you. I think that's a much better approach, I think.
Holy shit, I'm starting to feel like a relatively not terrible parent. So what I always say to the kids is... Yeah. I don't know, but mm-hmm. I know how to find out.
Absolutely. And I think it's actually better to own that so that our children don't go out, you know, and sort of pretend to know stuff, because there's a difference between opinion and knowledge.
Back to the book, bullshitting.
Yeah.
That bit on bullshit was fantastic.
Thank you. I'm really grateful you enjoyed that. I enjoyed writing it.
I bet.
I loved writing this book. Towards the end, I felt more confident because it came together so nicely and does become a little political because we start talking about zero-sum games and economics and politics and, you know, talk a little bit about immigration policies. So there's a little bit of politics going on.
But you can't get into misinformation and disinformation and not talk politics.
Yeah.
But the beauty of what you've done here is there is a very obvious recent example, mm-hmm. and that's turbocharged all of that. But you go right back to the early part of the last century, and that's really, really fascinating and talking about media control and how a story is propagated. I knew bits of it, but I didn't know all.
So yeah, really I actually nice. Went to the British Library for, we won't give it away, but I spent weeks in the British Library trying to find a specific document where I can pull it all together. And it was totally worth it because people were like, whoa, I didn't know. I'm like, yeah, it was cool. Happening way before you thought fake news was a modern thing. Yeah.
And who knew? The fucking Daily Mail were right in the middle of it.
Oh,
what are the odds?
True to form. True to form. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Have you got any questions for me, Alex?
Well, I heard, because I do my research as well, on one of your podcasts that the award will include fiction and nonfiction books, which is interesting because these are quite separate categories, right? In terms of type of book and genre, it's going to be very hard for you to judge. And I'm just wondering how my book, for example, will be judged against something that is fiction.
We've got a very, very, very broad sort of range of experience on the judging panel. And I'm really, really pleased with the judging panel.
Really good. Yeah, it's amazing. I saw the people.
There's one person missing off that because they haven't got her bio and her headshot yet, and that's a lady called Christy Eichelman, who's director of marketing at GLI. But yeah, Christie's terrific. She's what she doesn't know about marketing isn't worth knowing. Mm. A little bit of guidance will be given to the judges, but only a little bit, because mm-hmm. I want them to bring their perspective on it. Mm-hmm. I suspect that in years to come, we will divide it and make fiction and nonfiction. Mm-hmm. But what we were thinking in this inaugural edition was we can have a super, super strong field with terrific writers, because some stuff is nonfiction, but would be best described as gambling adjacent. And I mean, there's an argument for a third category for that, you know. But what we didn't necessarily want to do was to become bogged down in how to win at blackjack books.
Oh, well, and there's so many strategy books out there, right? I mean, the market is flooded.
That's why we had to rule out self-published as well, because we would have just been absolutely inundated. Mm-hmm. With stuff, and it all takes time. It takes time to get the books in. It takes time to speak to the authors. It takes time to read them.
Absolutely. So I know, for example, the Women's Book Prize, as a new book prize for fiction and nonfiction, was launched last week, and the judges are getting 6 months to read all the books that are on the shortlist. Yeah. Because they have to read all the books, and then they have several meetings, but that's going to be...
As you're getting about 6 weeks for the shortlist.
Oh, wow. Well, there is several interviews that I've given on this. Actually, Daily Mail gave me a huge, nice write-up so for the book. That was pretty cool. So nice. You can just read that. It was a nice long, and Poker.org has written about it. So I have both sort of, you know, mainstream media and the industry. And this is what I really enjoyed, because, and you will see from the quotes within the inside of the book, you have industry people, but also you have people from outside of the gaming world really connecting with the subject.
Yeah.
And for me, not to sort of, you know, champion too much my own book, but the types of books I love are the ones that can teach me and bring two fields together and show the connection between them. And I find these types of books really fulfilling and hugely rewarding. So I hope that once you finish reading it, if you make it to the end, that you feel the same, that, you know, that you've learned a bit.
I will definitely make really it to the end. I will definitely make it to the end. So anybody who's listening wants to look at this book. It's The Truth Detective by Alex O'Brien. O'Brien with an E. That's, you know, towards the end of the O'Brien part. It's not A. Brian or anybody, just in case. It might be stupid people listening. The Truth Detective, Lessons from Poker on Risk, Reward, and Imperfect Information. You can find out more about Alex at alexob.co.uk. And maybe you'll get to meet Alex in Barcelona.
Maybe. Hopefully. I'd love that.
Who knows?
Who knows? Well, thank you so much for having me.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You can find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just at Gambling Files. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share, tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.